Hello, everybody. This is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, Dr. Diana Wiley. My husband, Brian Brewer, is the co-host for this program, and Dr. Jordan Tischler is our guest. He is a cannabis specialist, so perfect for today, 420. Today is April 20th, 420. Dr. Tischler graduated from both Harvard College and Harvard Medical School. Welcome to this program, Dr. Tischler. We're so glad you're here.
Well, thank you guys for having me on. It's such a pleasure.
So what you have, your website is inhalemd.com. And can you give us a little bit about your background and what led you to establish InhaleMD?
Sure. It's kind of an odd story. As you started to mention, my background is pretty, shall we say, conventional. I went to Harvard three times over, which, if you do that, we are affectionately known as Preparation H. And
yes.
and then I went and I practiced emergency medicine for about 20-odd years, the last 15 of which was at the VA. And as you can imagine, I spent a fair amount of time taking care of veterans whose lives were very much harmed by substances. And what that really means is alcohol, you know, 1 through 9 on the top 10, and then a smattering of other substances. And sort of became a de facto expert in at least the acute presentation of these sorts of problems. And then, about 10 years or so ago, Massachusetts, my home state, started talking about a referendum about medical cannabis. And I had one of those aha moments. You know, I said, God, I've seen so many people who have been so harmed by alcohol and other substances, and yet I've never seen anybody in my emergency room who'd been sick from cannabis. So if there's such a difference between what I'm seeing and, you know, the sort of boogeymen that people talk about, and now we're starting to think that maybe there's some evidence that this could be used as a medicine, maybe I should learn something about this. So I spent a number of years then really diving into this material. As you can remember, there was a certain period of time where everyone said, oh, yeah, but there's no evidence. And, you know, the reality, of course, is that there is a ton of evidence. Not all of it is super high quality. A lot of it has been developed for the purposes of seeking harm. But there's a lot of evidence, and if you're willing to, pun intended, weed through it, you can learn a lot about what this stuff is good for, right? That led me to thinking, oh, well, you know what? Now that I know all of this stuff, how am I going to employ this for people's benefit? And that's really how I ended up starting InhaleMD, because as you can imagine, the VA was not very interested in my, you know, practicing this kind of medicine. And frankly, even the major institutions of which I was a part, like the, you know, Harvard system, really are, their hands are tied by the federal government in terms of what the law says that they're allowed to do. So starting a private practice was the vehicle for my being able to take care of patients using this medicine.
And how long have you been in private practice now?
Goodness, I think we're on the 7th or 8th year.
Okay, good, good.
Yeah.
Yes. So I love that people have to wade through the evidence. Yeah, there's been, there can be so much more research, and we need more research on it. But once the government gets rid of the schedule, is it called Schedule A?
Schedule 1 in this country.
Schedule 1, yeah.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the federal government is standing in the way of our getting the kind of data that we would like. And I think that will change in the relatively near future. But what it will change to look like is pretty up in the air.
Yes. So we've noticed that, and in my practice and even in general, that couples are discovering or rediscovering the pleasures of combining cannabis and sex. And, of course, cannabis has lots of wonderful, pleasant physical effects. And I'm interested in what you have to say about it. But I hear from my couples that they get the warm glow all over the body, and there's an arousing tingle maybe in the genitals. The sense of touch, both as giver and receiver, are pleasantly amplified and extended. Can you talk about some of the other pleasant physical effects as a result of taking cannabis for sex?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you've mentioned a whole lot of it in terms of, the sort of heightened sensitivity, to touch and sound. But there's also a heightened sensitivity kind of on an emotional level. And then there are some other areas where things are actually kind of diminished, but they're diminished in a positive way, so that, for example, our sense of time is slowed a bit. That makes us less hurried. Our anxiety levels tend to drop. Our memory systems are slowed down a little bit, which is good for people who have negative responses, triggers, if you will, to sexual acts. So all of these things kind of combine to heighten the experience for people who are using this to amplify their sexual experience. And also, as a physician, sort of slightly more in the way I think, it helps dim down some of the obstacles that other people face when they're thinking about having a positive sexual encounter.
And there are some pitfalls. Brian, did you have a question about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, can you talk about any of the pitfalls or the reasons people should not use cannabis? Or if they use it, what might they encounter that might turn them off?
I'm sorry, Diane. I really couldn't hear Brian. Could you repeat what he had asked?
Yes. He's wondering about the possible pitfalls of some of the pitfalls of using that can come up for some couples.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The way I tend to think about cannabis is fairly medical in nature, and so I'm always thinking about what are the benefits and how do they compare to the risks. And we have to admit that there are risks. Right now we've gone, the pendulum has swung away from the sort of boogeyman kind of just say no, your brain on drugs kind of malarkey that we had in the 70s and 80s, but the pendulum has so swung in the other direction that there are people who are saying, cannabis should be treated like a vitamin, it should be in the water supply, and obviously the reality of the situation lands somewhere in between. I think that, there are a number of potential pitfalls, starting with sort of the least likely but most onerous are that, if people start using cannabis, some percentage of them, if they're not thinking about this in a thoughtful and careful and mindful way, are going to end up using too much of it, and that has potential both short-term and long-term consequences. In terms of the longer-term issues, if we build a tolerance to cannabis, which can happen over time if we use very high doses, we can ultimately develop enough tolerance that we become dependent on cannabis and have difficulty stopping or cutting back the use. Thankfully, that just doesn't happen very often and is really something that can be addressed by doing this in a thoughtful and mindful manner. But, in the shorter term, when we're just thinking about the sexuality, this is particularly more relevant to the penis-owning group, but you can, in fact, take enough cannabis that it's very difficult to remain in the moment with your partner and to get and maintain an erection, and that can obviously put a bit of a damper on the activities at hand. Women are a little bit more resilient in terms of dosing. There are some pitfalls, but they can be addressed sort of by knowing what you're doing, getting good advice about what you're doing, and sort of doing this in the right way. You had asked me earlier about dosing and approaches to that. You want me to kind of talk about that sort of thing?
Absolutely. And, Brian, sometimes the Can you hear me, Brian? Because the third line sometimes.
I'm going to hang up and dial back in and see if that helps.
Okay. Maybe Rodney, the
producer. I can barely hear Dr. Tischler as well, so I'll call back in.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Keep going. Okay.
Yeah, we'll keep going. live radio.
Yeah, it's you roll with the punches, right?
Sure, you have to. Yeah. It's a sign of good health to be resilient and
exactly.
Roll with the punches. Yeah, so, we were talking about possible pitfalls and sexuality in the moment. Now, you talked about some men that maybe have become dependent. They've used too much cannabis over the years. Does it take time, like alcohol, to actually develop a dependency on it?
Definitely. I think part of it also is a little bit, I kind of talked about being mindful and thoughtful, and I think that that's really the key. You know, if you're using cannabis at low doses a couple of times a week and you kind of keep to the right dosing range, then it's extraordinarily unlikely that you're going to develop a problem. On the other hand, if you kind of go to the opposite extreme, and I'm going to be a little bit hyperbolic about this, and you start sort of smoking weed all day long every day, there's a higher likelihood that you're going to develop a physical dependence on the substance and potentially have a use disorder, psychological component to that. So obviously, I would strongly recommend to people that they take sort of the first approach and not the second approach.
Yeah, because in my experience, both personally and seen my clients, my couples, personally, I don't have a problem with sex drive because I in general, but I have found that cannabis can increase one's sex drive a lot, and it does seem to promote better erections and stamina for some of the men, and they can experience a longer duration of arousal, and studies have also shown that cannabis users have sex more frequently than non-unit users.
That's right, absolutely.
And in addition, the analgesic effect of cannabis may help relieve the pain, allowing people to focus more on feelings of pleasure. I've had some good results in working with couples where the woman has vaginismus, and it can help her relax, although if it's a serious case, the vaginismus, for the listeners, is when the muscles surrounding the vagina close so tightly that they won't allow anything inside. So this is a lot of pain for a lot of women. But if I have found that if they use some CBD central oil, that it can help. It can help relax those muscles. Have you had experience with that, Dr. Tischler?
Yeah, I'm not terribly fond of CBD. I think it's not terribly effective or useful. I think the science on it is kind of not there yet. But I certainly have had plenty of experience using cannabis in the broader sense with women who have those sorts of problems. And I think it's extraordinarily helpful. I think that, one of the things that we have to understand, and perhaps your listeners do already understand this, is that, there are sort of an array of steps that kind of go into a positive sexual process. There's obviously some drive that you've mentioned. There's the arousal, which in men is getting an erection, and women is lubricating and relaxing the vaginal muscles. And then, then we talk about orgasms, and sort of finally a relaxation or satisfaction stage. And when we think about the conventional medical world, really we've got one medicine or one class of medicines that are helpful for men who have trouble getting erections. And that's kind of it, right? I mean, that leaves
that's
out
it.
All of those other stages for men, and it leaves the women out completely. you know, which is not a conspiracy. It's just that those medicines do what they do and they don't do what they don't do. Cannabis, on the other hand, can be helpful to both men and women in all four of those phases that we just talked about. So you're absolutely right. It can increase sex drive or libido for both men and women. It can help women with that relaxation and lubrication. It can help men get and maintain the erection, particularly if the dosing is correct. And then in terms of the intensity and frequency of orgasm, that can be very much amplified for women. It can help men achieve more satisfying orgasms at a more satisfying time, meaning that they have more staying power, that sort of thing that we kind of talked about. And then the interesting bit for me is that in that satisfaction phase, cannabis can actually boost circulating oxytocin, which is a hormone that's associated with the feelings of closeness and intimacy. And so overall, cannabis use kind of just amplifies and makes better the whole process for both genders, and that's a wonderful thing, again, if we can do it properly.
It is a wonderful thing, and for many women who are anorgasmic or pre-orgasmic, they really need to feel a sense of safety in the relationship in order to be vulnerable, to let go, and with the right dosage and the right amount of experience with her partner, she often I've experienced this. I've heard about it in my sessions that she's now having orgasms. She can let go. She can be vulnerable, and letting go for the first time, you know, because her inhibitions were relaxed and she was able to experience all the beautiful sensual sensations.
Absolutely.
I just want to pause for a minute, Brian. Do we have you back?
Yes, I'm back, but I'm still having a bad connection. But I'll jump in and say, wonder if Dr. Tischer can say more about dosage and methods of using cannabis.
I'm so sorry. Could you repeat that? No, I'm really having trouble hearing him.
Sorry. So he's wondering if you could talk about dosage.
Yes.
Yeah, because that's so important, and methods. For cannabis, for ingesting and dosage, especially for beginners?
You know, absolutely. And I will say that the goal as I see it, which is not unlike other medications, is always to use the least amount that we need. So the approach for a beginner and the approach for somebody who's been at this for a while isn't that different, because ultimately what we want to do is keep the dose low and consistent. There are, as you all are no doubt aware, a bazillion different products in the cannabis space. And I often say, look, if a human being has a surface or a hole, somebody has figured out a way to stick weed there. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's a good idea or that the products work, because unfortunately the way our country has rolled out cannabis in this reform process has been not to require any testing to see that things work as they say they do. But leaving all of those sorts of innovative approaches aside, the way I tend to think of things in terms of things that are reliable is that we can inhale cannabis or we can take it orally. And those two methods work very well in general. But for the sexuality issue, the issue in my mind with using this orally, say with an edible, a gummy or something like that, is that it takes a long time for that to work, meaning maybe on average an hour, but sometimes it can be more. And frankly, even with the same you and the same medicine, it can vary from day to day. So it's unpredictably longer as well. Now, if you're trying to work this into some sort of a coupled relationship, it's very difficult, I think, to get both partners you know, to land in the same place at the same time using the oral approach. So for sexuality, I think that the edibles are very much less than ideal. So that leaves us with inhalation. And I think it's important for people to hear me say inhalation as opposed to smoking, because as a physician, I don't recommend that people literally light the stuff on fire and inhale the smoke, because, of course, the smoke isn't very good for us, and we want our we want a nice and long and fruitful life with lots of sex. So when I talk about inhalation, I don't mean smoke, and I also don't mean those vape pens that everybody sees, because those things are not controlled devices and, in fact, can lead to inhalation of all sorts of toxins. So what I typically recommend to my patients is to vaporize cannabis flower, meaning ground-up cannabis botanical material goes into a specialized cannabis flower vaporizer that is smart enough to set the temperature to 350 degrees Fahrenheit and stay there. And that allows us to get all the medicine from the plant without burning anything. And when we do that, we can start to really think about dosing very specifically by inhalation. If we put a strain of cannabis in that machine that is between 15 and 20% THC, then we can estimate that each puff, each full deep breath, is about 5 milligrams of that THC, which is a very good starting point, 5 milligrams, one puff on that vaporizer. And that will kick in, say, 10 to 15 minutes, and that is also good in terms of then being able to figure out very slowly and carefully what the dose is that gets us to a place where we get those benefits towards sexuality without kind of overshooting the mark. It's also very nice that with some of these small little handheld devices, some of which even vibrate, you can work that sort of inhalation process into foreplay, and it works fast enough that it's not like you're saying, okay, well, let's have a sexy couple of puffs together, and then 2 hours later, now we're ready to go, right? I mean, this all works very smoothly and fluidly and gets everybody going at the same time.
That's very helpful. Brian, were you able to hear him? We're having
just barely. So I'll continue listening.
Okay. But Brian, I think that you and I have talked about this too, that edibles just don't work as well for most beginners, and especially combining with sex, for some of the reasons that Dr. Tischler said. It's less reliable.
Yeah, it's just hard to make it function. I'm sure that there are people out there listening who are going, you know, what are you talking about? I make it work. It works fine. And I'm sure that they do. And I'm sure one could sit with, a patient or a couple and walk them through the process of using an edible and success could be achieved. But I think if we're thinking about how do we do this in the sort of simplest, easiest, most likely to be successful fashion, then I would point the ship towards that vaporized cannabis.
So it's called vaporized cannabis. And so what's the difference between the vaporizer that you might get in a pot shop and like a pipe? Even with water in it. Can you describe the difference?
Sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. So, in a pipe, you've got some sort of a material, like it might be glass or ceramic or something like that, and it's got a bowl into which you would stuff that cannabis material, and then you would take a lighter or a match or something, and you would actually ignite that dried plant material and then inhale the smoke that comes through it, just like it were tobacco, even though it's not tobacco. So that's a pipe, and that's sort of the simplest form. And that's not functionally any different from rolling it into a joint and lighting that on fire. The water pipe that you mentioned, or what's often called the bong, is a device that between the bowl into which you put the cannabis to light and the mouthpiece is a reservoir of water that when you draw the smoke through, it bubbles through the water. And there is a myth that that bubbling the smoke through the water makes it safer because it filters out some of the junk, and that's actually been disproven. And we know that, in fact, using a bong is not any safer than using a pipe. What it does, however, is typically cool down the smoke, which you can imagine that the source of combustion is very hot, and that makes it more pleasant to inhale, but it isn't any safer. The safer alternative is this flower vaporizer that I have mentioned, because it's an actual computer-controlled device. So they're small, they fit in the palm of your hand, but it uses a computer to heat the cannabis in the bowl to a temperature, which I mentioned is 350, and at that temperature, the medicine essentially evaporates or boils off the plant material, but we're not actually igniting the plant material, so we're not creating any of those toxins. And that's the ideal situation, because then we're inhaling the medicine, but we're not getting anything dangerous along with it.
I think this is very helpful. This is very specific, too. So are there any, as a medical doctor, are there any medical contraindications for using cannabis?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, there are what we call relative contraindications. So an absolute contraindication would mean, nope, can't use it, full stop, end of discussion, right? But there aren't very many absolute contraindications to cannabis out there. There are relative ones, meaning, you know, you really need to think about this, but, you know, depending upon the details, it may or may not be all that important. And so, for example, one of them would be somebody who, has cardiac disease, right? So when we have sex, we know that people's the demand on the cardiovascular system goes up because we're exercising, and that in some instances people can develop chest pain because they're not getting enough blood to their heart. Cannabis can also increase your heart rate, so that if you kind of add these things together, there might be some increased risk of getting that kind of chest pain. On the other hand, this is the sort of thing where, you know, the appropriate response is not to say, oh, you can't use this, but we're going to do this gently and we're going to do this thoughtfully. And if we develop chest pain, we're going to take it seriously and, you know, seek medical attention. Most of the big contraindications actually come from using CBD, which can interact with a bunch of conventional medications. Cannabis itself doesn't typically do that, and CBD, as I mentioned, I don't think is particularly helpful. So, in fact, when we're thinking about cannabis for sexuality, there are fairly few concerns in terms of those conventional medical issues.
Well, that's good news, and I think that since sex is such good exercise, and it can be very aerobic,
absolutely,
and it can be enhanced by cannabis, then, you know, it's good for our hearts if we don't already have a heart problem. It's very good exercise.
Definitely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a study that was done, oh my God, this must be 30 years ago now, by a well-known cardiologist and his associates that looked at, did men have a higher risk of a second heart attack when having sex after their first heart attack? And what they found was that the risk was not elevated as long as they were having sex with their wife, but as soon as they were having sex with somebody they were not supposed to have sex with, then their heart attack risk went up. And so, you know, I don't know if that data has really stood the test of time, but I thought it was very interesting when it was new.
Oh, I remember that study well, and some people pointed to Rockefeller having sex with somebody, not his wife. His wife was Sonny, and he had a heart attack with his extramarital person. So
I think that could be rather embarrassing.
I think so, too. It's very embarrassing. So I would like to talk about playfulness. Let's go from embarrassment to playfulness, because I think one of the big advantages of cannabis is the feelings of euphoria that are generated by cannabis, and so it leads to a sense of playfulness and even silliness. And Brian and I experience this a lot. We have a lot of fun, just a lot of laughter and silliness when we have pot and make love. And for people that have inhibitions, I don't tend to have any, but it can lower inhibitions. So that people feel freer to express their playful self and maybe explore their sexual curiosity. And would you not agree? I wish we could bring Brian into this conversation so we could hear it and we could hear him. Brian, are you hearing us?
Just barely.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I totally agree. I think that people talk about cannabis provoking creativity, and then there's some debate about what that really means. But certainly in the bedroom, as you discussed, it allows people to feel freer to try new things, to discuss, new avenues to pursue together, and generally makes people less inhibited. And for some people, they're not all that inhibited to begin with, but this is just kind of an extra amping up. And then there are people where their inhibitions really sort of stand in the way of their getting what they want, in the bedroom or in other arenas. And I think under those circumstances, cannabis becomes a very important adjunct to helping them achieve the relationships that they're looking for.
Because perhaps then they've let down some of their guard, and they can be more vulnerable and more relaxed, and perhaps they're not triggered by past memories of sexual trauma. Yeah.
Well, and I think that we're more and more becoming aware of, PTSD in the non-veteran population, or non-combatant population. And I think that that's important. And this is one of the areas in which that kind of trauma manifests itself problematically is in the bedroom. And so cannabis can be very helpful, not only in sort of provoking the libido in the sort of broadest sense, but as you said, in terms of being able to diminish some of those memories and inhibitions to allow somebody to pursue and achieve the kind of closeness that they feel they need. And I think that's brilliant.
Yes. Are you able to talk about any of your veterans, your patients who have PTSD and have specifically benefited from using cannabis?
Yeah, that's not particularly about sex so much as it's just about the day-to-day life in the post-combatant period. But, PTSD in the veteran population is a huge problem, particularly, for the more recent veterans. And their lives are tremendously upended by the things that they witnessed or were party to. Cannabis does suppress some of the memory function, and in particular, the sort of intrusive thoughts that are frightening or upsetting. And so cannabis can be a very useful tool for suppressing that kind of negative reaction that allows then for people to kind of behave and exist in their environment in ways that are enjoyable to them as opposed to frankly frightening to them. So I think that's hugely important. It's also important to note that, when it comes to PTSD in the veteran population, while cannabis can be very helpful, it's also an area where we have a fair amount of data about it's going wrong, and that the veteran population can be prone to the influence of their buddies, and that often leads to a more is more use situation. And what we've seen in several studies, particularly coming out of Johns Hopkins, is that veterans can start on cannabis and go from no cannabis to very extreme amounts of cannabis use very, very quickly, particularly if they're not consulting with a medical professional and getting their advice just, you know, from their buddies. And that can kind of go from being potentially helpful to being not so helpful very quickly. So I think that that's an important thing when we're talking about veteran healthcare, as well as sort of how do veterans get their information. These are important things to address so that we can help veterans use cannabis, but use it in a way that's positive and doesn't sort of overshoot the mark so much that if it goes from, you know, beginning to dangerous all sort of in one short period of time.
Well, that leads me to a question about how important is set and setting when using cannabis. Because, yeah, the set and the setting. Because that would be part of the veterans using it in a way that is helpful and not destructive.
Absolutely. I think... just for the listeners who may not know this jargon, the set is short for mindset, and setting obviously is the sort of environment or milieu in which one is using this stuff. And, you know, as an extreme example, I say to my patients, look, until you know what you're doing with this stuff, don't use it on the subway, right? Because that's a frightening environment in which to be, with loud screeching noises and strangers coming at you in tight spaces and stuff like that. That's asking for trouble. Now, that's kind of an extreme example, but it sort of illustrates my point.
It does indeed.
I think that set and setting are hugely important, that whether we're talking about this as a general therapeutic or whether we're talking about it in a sexual context, the lead up is tremendously important. That again, having an environment in which all the partners feel safe and comfortable, warm if or not cold anyway. You know, having that kind of safe space is important for having good sex. And in addition, you know, to some degree, a way of looking at it is that if cannabis is going to amplify your feelings, you want them to be positive at baseline or at the beginning. So yeah, I think that that's hugely important. And then, as we talked about, being mindful, thinking about dose, right? I mean, the ultimate in sort of the recreational approach to things is with no thought whatsoever to dose. It's just sort of like, you know, see some cannabis, smoke some cannabis. And I think that that can work if one is looking for that kind of a, gee, I wonder what will happen kind of experience. But I think that most people who are using this in a therapeutic fashion, whether we're talking about treating PTSD or treating some sort of sexual encounter, they want something that's more predictable. They want to know that it is going to work, that it's going to be positive. It's not going to you're not going to overdo it. A lot of my patients come in, particularly at the beginning, and they're really more worried about what is this going to do to me than about necessarily like what can it do for me. So all of those things factor into the success of the experience. Knowing that you can focus on dose, knowing that you have control over that, and it's not just sort of a random amount that's going to leave you in some random state of incapacity. I mean, I think that's what people worry about, is that that cannabis is going to turn them into a drooling moron. And that just doesn't work that way, you know. But those are the fears that people come with, and we need to be able to address that. And since they can't know ahead of time what they're really going to feel like, I think that being able to focus on that dose and the route of administration gives people that control, and then they feel like they can handle it.
A lot of people are afraid to approach cannabis again because years ago they had a really bad trip with marijuana, and maybe in the old days, they ate some homemade brownies that where the dosage was not controlled, and they had a really bad trip, and they got really paranoid, and they just don't want to go there again. So the paranoia seems to be a stumbling block for a lot of people that would like to use cannabis to enhance sex or just to enhance pleasure in general. What about those folks? Getting them to put aside. Yeah, how do you handle that?
I think the answer to that is reassurance and handholding, right? I mean, I have lots and lots of people who've come to me, you know, in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, even in their 90s, you know, who tell me, oh, Sonny, you know, back in the 60s, I smoked some weed, and it was the worst thing ever, and I never want to do that again, you know. And I often used to say, if I had a nickel for every person who came to me and said, give me the kind of weed that doesn't make you high, and there isn't an effective kind of weed that doesn't make you high. Those things are bound together, and we have to know that and accept that. But we also have to know that when we had a bad experience way back when, first of all, we're not necessarily the same person in our 70s that we were in our 20s. But also, we weren't necessarily back then thinking about dose. We weren't thinking about the set and setting. So God only knows, you know, as you said, you might have gobbled down some brownie, could have been 150 milligrams in that brownie, and we're now talking about 5 milligrams.
That's right.
Or even just like you were at a party and somebody was passing along around a joint, right, and you took a couple of hits on that. You have no idea what the strength of that stuff was. Back in the day, there was hashish, which could be added into marijuana. Now we have even stronger concentrates that can be added into the cannabis flower. So you might think, oh, I just took two puffs on the joint, but unbeknownst to you, you know, that's not just a straight cannabis joint. It's got some other, you know, higher potency material in it. None of that's relevant to now, right? Those things happened back then and may very well explain having had a bad experience. But now, as mature people, we can be much more specific about what the dose should be and about how to purchase the right cannabis, how to use this cannabis safely. And I think all of that, and also, as you mentioned, you know, the set and setting thing, to be, like, not necessarily out at you know, some crazy frat party. No, now we're going to be at home with our partner and in our safe environment that we have built for ourselves over a lifetime. And it's just, it's sort of an apples to oranges comparison. But we know that people have these fears, and it's really just a matter of being able to sit with them and to go through all of this information that we're talking about. And then as a clinician, to be available to them, you know, and to say, look, here's how I want you to start. This is the very beginning. This is the toe in the water. And after you get your toe in the water, you send me an email and you let me know how did it go. And I am here for you, and this is how I plan to take care of you as my patient. And I think that, you know, almost never do they need to actually reach out to me. Sometimes they do, but not very often, because it's simply the fact that I've been able to present them with the option or the ability that they know that they have a safety net. It really hasn't seemed to be a major problem for most people once we kind of get past that once we get past the concern and get to the reassurances, things seem to actually go smoothly.
And if people visit your website, inhalemd.com, I noticed that you offer virtual sessions with people, or advice, or, you know, for people that have put their toe in the water and they need some guidance after that. Is that open to most people, or how do you work that with your website, inhale.com? I mean, inhalemd.com.
In the COVID era, I've actually given up my physical offices completely, and we do everything online at this point. And it's, you know, there's some adjustment involved in that, but on balance, I think it's been a very good thing. And it has allowed me to reach out to and take care of people, you know, across the country and really around the globe in ways that we couldn't before. So this has been a great thing. So if people are listening and they would like some coaching on this sort of thing, absolutely reach out to me. inhalemd.com. It's very easy to get in touch with us. And we welcome anybody at any stage of this process.
I think it's wonderful that you're doing this. It's so needed. People's experiences and their lives can be so much enhanced. Brian came up with this quote from Carl Sagan, "Cannabis enhances the enjoyment of sex. On the one hand, it gives an exquisite sensitivity, but on the other hand, it postpones orgasm." And so he was saying that you can last longer, I think. The exquisite sensitivity postpones orgasm. He's referring to the delay in male ejaculation, probably. And this would allow the man to remain erect for prolonged periods of time. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yep, yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I tend to think of cannabis as sort of the thing that creates equilibrium, right? And so if you're a man and you ejaculate too soon, cannabis will help you go a little longer. If you're an older gentleman and you have the problem that you're having trouble actually having an orgasm, it will help you have an orgasm sooner. If you're having orgasms but they're kind of meh, this will help you have more earth-shattering orgasms. And that's true for men and women.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I kind of see it as, I hate to say this because this sounds sort of like the magic bullet that we know no medicine really is, but at least when it comes to sexuality, if we're doing it properly, it really kind of makes it better. You know, whatever the issues are, it has a tendency to sort of ameliorate those issues so that sex can be more fulfilling.
I couldn't agree more with you, and I think especially among my female clients, there are, and those with really low desire, and especially women who are post-menopause, and they feel kind of dried up. They want to want, but they don't have any desire. And so if they can have the right dosage and the right delivery and in the right set and setting, then they can have an experience of having desire again. And,
yes.
And it is mind-blowing, and it's transformative. I was so relieved when the state of Washington legalized recreational marijuana in 2012, because I had been recommending cannabis to very select clients, for a number of years. I've been doing this work for about 35 years. In the past, most of it was in California. But it's just been remarkable to see these women embrace their sexuality and be able to let go, and then they have very happy husbands. I'm working with a couple right now, and she had early menopause, and they haven't had sexual intercourse for 20 years. That's a long time.
Oh, that's a long time.
And for somebody like that, you know, she also probably needs some topical estrogen for the dry vagina. But it's a complicated situation and case. But marijuana just helps so much.
I think you just touched on something really important, you know, which is that we have a tendency to focus on the person in front of us, which is, of course, very appropriate. But we also have to remember the greater context, which is the relationships that they have. And for a lot of people in that postmenopausal female state that you mentioned, we also have to remember, not talked about very much, is about 30% of men, including young men, have low libido just at baseline. And so there are women out there who are mad at their male partners because the male partners are not sort of meeting their needs. There's a whole range of of partnered conflict, if you will, that we can address by using cannabis because it makes the sex life work better.
Yes, yes. And I want to check in with my fabulous partner because he's not able to participate too much, and I feel so badly about that because Brian has so much to offer in this field.
I'm here, but not you know, it's a poor connection. Why don't you ask Dr. Tischler about what does he see in terms of the stoner stigma stereotype being replaced by healthier models of cannabis use?
Okay, so, I think I heard what he said about stoner stigma.
The stoner stigma. That's a good question, yeah, being replaced.
Yes, and particularly appropriate for 420, of course. I think the stoner stigma is still with us a little bit. And, you know, and I think that it's kind of harmful, kind of. You know, I mean, on the one hand, we owe Cheech and Chong a very great debt of gratitude for keeping cannabis in the minds of mainstream America through the 70s and 80s. But, you know, now at this point, there's just so much of that that has become ingrained in the mentality of what it means to use cannabis, that I think that stands in the way of mainstream Americans taking, you know, seriously considering it as a beneficial or therapeutic intervention. I think that will go away, and that, you know, I'll tell a little story about that, if I may. And some years ago, I took my daughter, who was then a preteen or early teen, to a rock concert. And we were standing there, and the smell of cannabis came by. And she sniffed at the air and said, "Daddy, what's that smell?" And I said, "Sweetheart, that's what cannabis smells like." And without me saying a beat, she said, "Why would anyone be using their medicine here?" And I said, so that's the mentality that's going to change the world, right? Is when she, and she's now almost 19, and her cadre really get into power, they're going to think about this stuff in ways that we don't and can't because we were subject to the whole Nancy Reagan thing and, you know, and eggs in frying pans. And I think no matter what, we never completely get away from that. We've always got that little voice in the back of our head saying, you know, this is bad for you, shame on you. And I think, you know, there's no truth to that, but I think it's still in there and we can try to get past it. The younger generation, they don't have it. So that stoner stuff will go away. It's just take a little bit longer.
Yeah, because we really do need these healthier models of cannabis use. And when it comes to the stoner stigma, And let's talk a little bit about the health factors. You know, of course, older people have discovered this, seniors, but I want to talk about how much better cannabis is for you than alcohol in terms of especially a lot of alcohol. Let's just talk about comparing cannabis and alcohol.
Well, in some ways, I think it's not a very good comparison because in many ways, you know, we look at cannabis more and more as a medicine, as it should be, and alcohol really isn't something that we use therapeutically in medicine any longer. So in some ways, that's a bit of an apples to oranges comparison. But if you really just want to look at kind of the risks and harms, we know that about 15% of people who use alcohol will develop the physical dependence that we were talking about earlier in the show. And that's compared to an average of around 7% of cannabis users who might develop problematic cannabis use. And that number, 7%, is actually a little bit misleading because the risk is higher in teenagers and it's lower in older adults. So for people who've made it to the ripe old age of 25, their risk is probably around 2 or 3%. So just in terms of the physical dependence, there's a very large difference. But then there's also the question of, like, what does that dependence look like and what happens to you and what other things can happen to you, right? So people who use alcohol can develop heart disease and liver disease and bleeding ulcers and ultimately develop, you know, loss of cognitive function and all those sorts of things. And you know what? It just doesn't happen with cannabis. It doesn't create heart disease. It doesn't create liver disease. Nobody gets ulcers from it. And there's really no evidence, even, you know, convincing evidence for long-term use on cognitive function. And in fact, in the patient population, cognitive function seems to get better because whatever the intoxication phase of the cannabis is, it's nothing compared to the deficits created by being sick. So if you can take somebody from feeling sick to feeling better but stoned, you know what? That's a net improvement. So the comparison between cannabis and alcohol, you know, cannabis wins hands down.
Willie Nelson, his public statement regarding being caught with a bag of marijuana, he said, "It's a good thing I had a bag of marijuana instead of a bag of spinach. I'd be dead by now."
Okay.
Yeah. Well, he's promoted the health benefits, and he's been a longtime user, and he even has his own brand, I think, now. Doesn't he have his own brand of...
Willie's Reserve, and I don't mean that to be a plug because I have no connection other than being a fan of his music. But yes, he's yes. definitely been out there extolling the virtues of cannabis. And, you know, I think he's got a point. Cannabis can be very good medicine. Again, if we use it properly and we use it with thought to dose and in whom we're using it so that we're getting the best effects possible.
Dr. Tischler, do you think that federal prohibitions on cannabis will be eased or lifted anytime soon? And if so, what do you think may happen then to the industry and maybe to the culture? It's a big question, but as we wind up the show, I think a good one.
Sure. I think it's a great question. It's hard to answer that question. I can see a number of things potentially happening. Right now, clearly the Biden administration is trying to figure out its position. And the president, and Biden is no different from any previous president, has the ability to direct the DEA to reschedule cannabis. Rescheduling means it's not taken out of the control of the DEA, but it's moved from Schedule 1, which says, no, you can't touch it, not at all, nothing, you know, you go right to jail, no $200. And you put it into some of the other schedules, like Schedule 2, which is where Percocet and Oxycodone live, Schedule 3, where codeine lives, Schedule 3 also contains some of the benzodiazepines like Ativan. So these are prescribable, but it requires an extra little thought process to make sure you're doing it right. And the president can simply basically wave his pen and that happens. And no president has ever touched that. One might think that there's perhaps a landmine associated with that, and I don't really know the details of what goes through a president's mind when she or he is thinking about these things. But that's one possibility. The other is that you've seen over the last few years a lot of legislation introduced into Congress, none of which has really gone anywhere. And quite frankly, part of the reason it's not gone anywhere has been because these have been grandstanding bills that don't actually tackle the nitty and gritty of how this would work. But we're expecting in the next few weeks to months that Senators Booker and Schumer are going to introduce a new reform bill that's supposed to be very comprehensive. And that may, in fact, start to get some traction, because if it really does address some of the nitty and gritty, then there will be an opportunity for negotiation between the parties and you know, come to something solid enough to then pass. I will
Dr.
say
Fisher,
that I have...
we've run out of time. I want to thank you. Yes. This has been a most enlightening show. And I really appreciate your being on it on this special day, 420. We'll be in touch. Thanks again, Dr. Tischler.
Thank you. This is a great pleasure. Happy 420.
Happy 420, everybody. Bye-bye.